elections, your government, your media, and your planet. Right here on KPFK, your only real independent voice on the airwaves in Los Angeles. Please go to kpfk.org and click donate to join the circle today.
Hi, this is Lisa Gay Hamilton, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
Relationship, rather, between the district and its workforce. It just doesn't make sense.
And partnership means equal respect. We're hopeful that we can start working towards not having workers live in poverty and making sure that we have robust staffing to be able to care for our students and that we finally achieve clean, safe, supportive schools for all.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, a union town.
Good morning, and welcome to another working week. This is KPFK's Working Voices. I'm your host, Joe Ayala, president of NABIT CWA Local 53. And in this morning's show, Working Voices executive producer Dan McCrory talks to Naomi Martinez and Veronica Gonzalez at the Baristas and Billionaires screening. Steve Zeltzer's Labor Media takes us to a rally at the federal courthouse in Oakland, where Elon Musk has his lawsuit against Sam Altman and OpenAI. Kristen Parker has the latest news from UTLA's contract settlement. And we have labor and economic views from this morning's Working Voices update. All this and more coming up this morning on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. This is Working Voices.
In our first offering this morning, Working Voices executive producer Dan McCrory interviews Naomi Martinez and Veronica Gonzalez from Starbucks Workers United at the Baristas and Billionaires screening.
This is Dan McCrory with Working Voices talking to a couple of ladies who are members of the Starbucks workers who are organizing other workers. And what's the name of the organization itself?
Starbucks Workers United.
And you are?
I am Naomi Martinez.
And I'm Veronica Gonzalez.
And how long have you been up to this?
I think about 4 or 5 years between the both of us.
We started
in around 2022.
Was it kind of a spontaneous thing, or was it well planned out, or how did it all start?
I had worked for Starbucks for 5 years when we started talking about organizing, and we were inspired. We got connected to the Starbucks workers in Buffalo that were organizing online via Instagram. And so I followed them on social media, and they put out a call for other workers that wanted to try to organize to reach out. And so me and my coworkers reached out and started organizing in the year of 2022.
Have you ever tried anything like that before?
Never. No, this is my first time forming a union.
And what was it like?
It wasn't really difficult considering we already had a union existing within our store. And when I say that, I mean all of me, myself and my coworkers all had each other's backs. And so
that's so important.
It's so important. And that's why when it came to organizing, it was really easy because we all had been through the ringer with this company and the working conditions we were constantly under with the understaffing, the ever-changing expectations, and just the constant under-support from management. It was a really easy choice to organize because we all agreed that we deserved better. And for the amount of time of our lives that we were spending at the store, none of us should have been struggling the way we were.
Yeah. When did you get involved?
Yeah, I got involved around 2022, sort of a similar way. I was already working at Starbucks and I saw online that an organizing drive had started in Buffalo, New York. And so I reached out right away on my own, really just out of curiosity. My store's journey into organizing was a little different in that it took a few months for my coworkers to really kind of internalize deserving more. My coworkers thought that everything was okay. After we had a lot more experiences on the job where we got to start pointing out the conditions as irregular, we just had normalized our treatment for so long. And so it took a few months, but we had a successful unionization at my store after about 6 months.
And what were your individual stores?
My store was in Phoenix, Arizona, in the suburbs of Avondale.
And mine was here in Los Angeles, in, you know, a place so close to my heart. It's where I grew up, Cypress Park, in Northeast Los Angeles.
And what was so bad about the conditions at the stores?
Well, I myself was a shift supervisor at the time that we were organizing. And I mean, I would have my coworkers who were easily clocking in 40 hours a week, willing to do any type of overtime, coming in and having their only meal be the food item that was their mark out on their lunch. And so it's not just Starbucks's exploitation of it, but like the cost of living in Los Angeles is so high that this Starbucks that was right down the street from my entire life, from my high school, from my middle school, and from my elementary school, was actively exploiting everyone there, where we're all constantly in there. We're all constantly stressed because of the overwork. Our store was really busy, the most busy in our district, and it was making easily $80,000 a week. And management just continuously telling us that, you know, we just had to work harder. We just had to, you know, be faster, and we just had to do better, all for shareholders. And we all, none of us were flourishing at this job. A majority of my coworkers were living under the poverty line and sustaining their family members on a Starbucks salary, which at the time, salary, it's not even a salary, but an hourly wage. And at that time, hourly wages were as high as $16. And even then, that wasn't because that's what Starbucks was paying workers. It's because workers were fighting for $15 at the time and the fighting for wage increases that the company was never going to give us. And so something had to give. And if the company wasn't going to change, we were going to do it.
How has the fight been?
And the fight's been rough. It's a multi-billion dollar corporation. I've learned a lot from the time of trying to organize versus winning our union and now supporting other workers to organize. I mean, it's been rough, but you know, we as workers are resilient. And like Naomi said, we teach ourselves, and we're also taught to accept these horrible conditions. So realistically, once we take our power back, the conditions are really nothing, and this fight is nothing, because we have that bigger in us for a better world. And so, yeah, it's been rough with a company that union busts and has poured so much money and time and effort into crushing their workers instead of supporting them. I mean, that bit isn't easy, but if we don't fight, I mean, what is this world going to look like? So it's not easy, but we know that.
And from what I understand, the latest polls show that 70% of Americans support unions. So The time must be right for you guys.
Yeah, most of it's really hopeful data. And I think we see that a lot when workers are reaching out. I mean, we talk to workers in California every day who are done with being treated like less than. And so even in such dark times, there is so much hope coming in every day. And we know that that will lead us to victory in the end.
So how long do you think this is going to go on?
I think that as long as we're keeping the pressure up on Starbucks, that will win. But oh man, I wish I could give a timeline.
We're ready to negotiate right now.
Yeah, we're ready. And it's really up to the company to take bargaining seriously and approach the negotiations table in good faith.
One thing that we say in the labor movement is it's going to take as long as it takes plus one day.
Yeah, and we're ready on that one day longer.
Very good. Is there anything that you've learned from this experience that will help you in the future? In other words, do you want to be a union organizer again?
I think what I learned when I was a barista in the first few years was After a certain amount of years in organizing, you're in it for life. And I definitely feel that commitment to the movement. No matter how hard it is, workers everywhere want to be organized. They want to fight. And I want to be in the center of that.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time.
Yay. Thank you.
You have anything else you want to add?
For consumers, I mean, if you are...
How can we support you?
Yeah. If you are still shopping at Starbucks, stop. We need as much support from consumers' dollar as possible. And so take that dollar and invest it in something else, whether that's a local coffee shop or just another, you know, endeavor. And if you have the Starbucks app, delete it. That's really important financials for this company. People load hundreds of dollars into that app every day that this company pours into union busting. And so delete the app and use your dollar elsewhere.
And my wife's not going to like that one.
Sorry, wife.
Yeah. So are there picket lines in California?
We just wrapped up the longest strike in Starbucks history. We're returning and building more power throughout the United States by organizing more stores and just supporting workers that way. And so as of right now, there's no active pickets, but there are actions happening all across the United States that you can tap into and see when you sign the No Contract, No Coffee pledge.
Is there a website people can go to?
Yeah, the No Contract, No Coffee. If they just type it in, they'll find it. SBWorkersUnited.org also is some website they can utilize. But yeah.
Very good. Wish you guys the best of luck.
Thank you so much. Yeah. A working class hero is something to be in. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
That was Working Voices executive producer Dan McCrory in an interview at the Baristas and Billionaires screening with his guests Naomi Martinez and Veronica Gonzalez from Starbucks Workers United. For more information on Starbucks Workers United, you can find them at sbworkersunited.org. Forget paid what our labor is worth. That's why we often in the days on the way to our work. And when we get there, we can't wait to be out. So let me tell you what it's about.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
I'm Working Voices Associate Producer Hal Lohr, and in this morning's Working Voices Update, the question this morning goes, should someone's work in immigration enforcement during the Trump administration preclude them from having a job in California's civil service? And it seems to be a question that many California Democrats, angry enough at the administration's aggressive immigration tactics, are prepared to take up. On a party-line vote, the state's Senate Public Safety Committee passed a bill Tuesday that would disqualify people from becoming local or state police officers if they personally participated in federal immigration enforcement beginning on or after January 20th, 2025. That's the date when Donald Trump started his second term as dictator-in-chief and soon after launched the federal occupation of California. Under the new bill, former agents at, say, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement or Customs and Border Protection would be able to apply to be police officers only after at least 10 years have passed since leaving their federal agency jobs. That could be a setback for them because jobs in California law enforcement often pay better and often have more generous benefits than their federal government counterparts. During her testimony in support of the bill, Margot George of the California Public Defenders Association said that the bill is protective rather than punitive, and that police officers wield extraordinary authority. The bill recognizes that individuals who have participated or enabled unlawful enforcement of custodial practices, where cruelty and racial discrimination are not only tolerated but incentivized, should not occupy roles in public trust in California. Naturally, California law enforcement groups oppose the measure, arguing that the bill does not specify for individuals who have a record of wrongdoing or improper conduct. And Murrieta Republican State Senator Kelly Sciardo, who cast the lone no vote, called the bill ridiculous and unfair to so many people that are good people that are working for an agency and they're just doing their jobs. Obviously, ignoring that whole recognizes the individual who have participated in and enabled unlawful enforcement and custodial practices where cruelty and racial discrimination are not only tolerated but incentivized, which could maybe indicate a possible, if not probable, job candidate with a predilection for behaviors that Californians wouldn't seek in a member of their police forces. But the committee also raised concerns that the bill could violate the U.S. Constitution, citing that a federal judge recently halted a new California law banning local and federal officials from wearing masks, and analysis of the bill warns an anti-ICE hiring ban could face the same federal scrutiny. Authoritarian protectionism at its finest. Let's talk oil. Last year, Long Beach celebrated a deal Synergy Oil and Gas negotiated with a regional wetlands authority in Southern California. A former oil field, 154 acres of land in the city of Long Beach, would become public wetlands. In exchange, Synergy Oil and Gas would gain a more valuable property and environmental credits. But a California law meant to keep wells away from homes and schools thwarted the company's plan for more drilling, and now the wetlands deal has become fodder for the Trump administration's war against California clean energy policy. U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright, a Trump appointee who formerly served as the CEO of Liberty Energy, North America's second largest hydraulic fracking company, traveled to the property owned by Synergy Oil and Gas last Wednesday to attack Governor Gavin Newsom and California state energy policies, accusing the governor and the policies of increasing oil costs for Californians and warning the Trump administration will be challenging them. Wright's visit to the Synergy site comes just a week after a U.S. District Court denied the U.S. Department of Interior's request to stop enforcement of California's setback law, while a broader legal challenge is pending. Pointing to the Synergy oil deal while ignoring study after study that cite where oil being traded on a global exchange precludes California oil from affecting local gas prices, Secretary Wright, parroting MAGA drill baby drill rhetoric, accused California fossil fuel policies that limit oil and gas are starving the state of jobs as they enfeeble California, claiming unjustifiably against all global economic indicators that when you make energy expensive by importing it and putting ridiculous regulations on it, you not only make it more expensive to pay your bills, but you make it so businesses aren't going to locate in your state. Statements that ignore that despite state regulation and clean energy policies, California at 246,000 barrels per day, which alone would be more than enough to sustain California's domestic need, California remains the eighth largest crude oil producer in the United States, as well as being the fourth largest economy by GDP on the planet. But Secretary Wright's visit does point up the active fight on multiple fronts between California and the White House over U.S. big oil's access to California resources versus California energy and environmental policy, particularly on gasoline prices, where the state claims that California's gas prices are the highest in the nation, due particularly to oil company gouging, with a pricing gap now exacerbated further in the wake of global oil market disruptions following Trump's unjustifiable preemptive U.S. military strikes on Iran. But federal and state battle notwithstanding, the Los Cerritos Wetland Authority, a state-local public partnership, began negotiating for Synergy Oil to swap land with Long Beach when state law still permitted new oil wells. Synergy would be free to seek permits to drill on its new parcel of land, while Long Beach would acquire new public space. But in 2024, after the deal was finalized, the state started enforcing SB 1137, a setback law banning new oil wells within 0.6 of a mile of homes, schools, and other populated areas. That made it nearly impossible for Synergy to get permits for their new property to produce more than 100 barrels per day because of those state limits. Earlier this year, the Trump administration sued California over the setback law, arguing it illegally blocks businesses that the federal government oversees. the administration cited two land management laws, the Mineral Leasing Act and the Federal Land and Policy Management Act, that authorize public land for oil, gas, and coal development. While the lawsuit is pending, the U.S. Department of Interior requested a preliminary injunction that would bar the state from enforcing the setback law. But a U.S. District Court judge denied that request and called California's setback law a reasonable environmental regulation that doesn't bar alternative methods of accessing oil in the state. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, California's setback law would invalidate about a third of federally authorized oil and gas leases in California. Oil company leases largely held in impoverished Black and Latino communities around the state where public health studies have shown oil drilling to create serious questions. The setback law is just one front in a wider political battle that has put Gavin Newsom in an increasingly difficult position. Newsom blames the White House for gas price increases, arguing that Trump's actions are irresponsible. At the same time, Newsom in 2024 pushed to delay parts of the oil setback law, arguing regulators needed more time to implement it, extending deadlines to monitor wells near homes and schools for leaks to July 2030, while keeping the core buffer zone restrictions for new oil drilling in place. The Trump administration continues pushing to expand oil production in California, including plans to revive offshore drilling along the Santa Barbara coast at the site of the 2015 Refugio oil spill, where a pipeline now owned by Texas-based Sable Offshore Corporation ruptured. In April, U.S. Department of Energy Chris Wright invoked the Defense Production Act to order the restart of operations, overriding local courts, arguing the oil was vital to our national security and defense. But California's Attorney General Rob Bonta has sued Wright, arguing he overstepped his authority. The case could open a window on how far federal officials can go in using national security or emergency powers to override state authority, a strategy that faces long odds in California, where overwhelming public sentiment, politics, and economic realities of oil and gas have shifted sharply towards renewable energy and against new fossil fuel development. Meanwhile, in Long Beach, work to remove old wells to create more public space on Synergy oil and gas property continues. In city news, the Los Angeles Homeless Service Authority Monday announced it will issue layoff notices to nearly 300 employees, citing impending funding cuts at the county level. In compliance with state law, LAHSA formally notified the union representing its employees, SEIU Local 721, about the layoffs, as well as the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, Mayor Karen Bass, and state officials. In total, LAHSA is expected to lay off 284 employees, with their final day of work being June 30th, the last day of the fiscal year. LAHSA said the layoffs are part of a restructuring that will eliminate 414 positions, of which 130 are vacant positions. The layoffs will reduce the staff from 600 to 320 employees, with about 53 additional vacant positions, according to Ahmad Chapman, a spokesman for the agency. The announced layoffs will follow a signed contract between LAHSA and SEIU Local 721, which requires a 60-day notice. While the layoffs are expected to move forward, LAHSA officials said some of these positions could be saved after June 30th, depending on the final details of the city's budget. My fellow commissioners and I are committed to this necessary restructuring to ensure system continuity. What matters most right now is reshaping LAHSA to provide uninterrupted support for the service providers on the front lines every single day, working to end homelessness across Los Angeles, Amber Seek, chair of the LAHSA Commission, said in a statement. Last Monday, LA Mayor Karen Bass unveiled her proposed $14.89 billion budget for the 2026-2027 fiscal year. It would allocate about $788 million for homelessness spending, a 17.3% decrease compared to the current fiscal year. Of the proposed spending, funding for LAHSA is expected to increase from $50.65 million to $52.82 million, according to city documents. City spending on LAHSA is expected to maintain the annual point-in-time homeless count, continuum of care administration services, shelter and housing intervention, and strategies to address street homelessness. Meanwhile, LAHSA officials touted their work on homelessness. Officials said they've reduced street homelessness by 14 and 18% countywide and citywide, respectively, citing the annual PIT homeless count. LAHSA also said they made 77,834 permanent housing placements, and beginning in July, the agency is expected to focus on the operation of the Homeless Management Information System and Coordinated Entry System, governance and system performance, and overseeing the annual homeless count and lead grant awards. As part of this transition, LAHSA's contracting and program oversight role will be refocused primarily on the city. In 2025, the Board of Supervisors approved the creation of the county's first homelessness department and authorized the transfer of some employees and about $300 million in funding from LAHSA to the new agency. The decision came in response to audits that found LAHSA had failed to properly track spending and service outcomes. The Department of Homeless Services and Housing formally launched in January, with county officials expecting the departments to be fully operational by July. The Los Angeles City officials are discussing a similar move to shift some programs away from LAHSA over in the next fiscal year. And on the healthcare front, UC's service and hospital workers are set to strike next month as the union that represents them, with more than 42,000 service and hospital workers across the University of California, has announced plans to stage an open-ended strike at all campuses next month starting May 14th, after more than 2 years of failed negotiations that have led to this point. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Local 3299 has been negotiating with the university system for over 2 years. The union's membership includes custodians, food service workers, patient care assistants, and hospital technicians. Members say their wages have failed to keep pace with inflation and that they've been priced out of local housing markets. The AFSCME has filed unfair labor practice charges with the Public Employment Relations Board, formally accusing the UC system of violating California labor law. In a press statement, the UC system said it has exchanged proposals on wages, health care, and working conditions with the union, reaching agreement on 26 contract articles to date. But Heather Hansen, a spokesperson for the university system, claims disappointment that AFSCME is moving toward this open-ended strike despite real progress made at the bargaining table. Hansen said the UC proposals include wage increases of 32%, or more through 2029. But the union claims the UC system is touting fuzzy math, where more than a third of the proposed wage increases are not applicable to all workers. When asked about the unfair labor practice charges filed by the union, Hansen said that just because AFSCME has filed these charges doesn't mean that they have merit. Last fall, the union staged a two-day strike, and if the AFSCME decides to carry out the open-ended work stoppages this spring, UC hospitals already have robust contingency plans in place to ensure patients, students, staff members, and faculty are minimally impacted. More on this as it develops. This is Working Voices Associate Producer Hal Lohr with this morning's Working Voices Update.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
Next up, Kristen Parker from the Montebello Teachers Association brings us the latest teacher union news from UTLA, SEIU 99, and the LAUSD, which signed their new contracts last week, putting an end to the threat of what could have been the nation's largest possible teacher strike this year.
This is Kristen Parker from the Montebello Teachers Association with an update on recent LAUSD news. As most of you are aware, the threatened LAUSD strike was averted as unions reached agreements with the unions where union employees won pay raises and other concessions before a strike that would have shut down schools for nearly 400,000 LA students even began. Schools in the nation's second largest school district are now open as usual to the relief of many families who had scrambled to make childcare arrangements that could have lasted for months. The newly signed agreement, which includes a 24% increase over 3 years, was the final milestone needed to avert a walkout. The three unions, each with separate contracts, cover about 70,000 of the LAUSD's 83,300 employees and nearly all campus workers. Their pact to walk out together if any of them could not reach a deal was the first in LA Unified history. Under the new contracts, UTLA, representing about 37,000 teachers, nurses, counselors, psychologists, and librarians, received an average pay increase for its members of 13.86% over a 2-year pact, and that the annual salary of a starting teacher would immediately rise to $77,000 from $68,965, an 11.7% jump. The new UTLA contract will also add more than 450 attendance office workers, psychiatric social workers, school psychologists, and counselor positions. The contract includes provisions to control class sizes for students with disabilities, including extra pay for teachers whose classes exceed the cap. AALA, which represents about 3,000 administrators, including principals and assistant principals, has reached a deal that includes a pay increase of 11.65% over 2 years and an opportunity to bargain for an additional raise in the final year of their 3-year contract. The new agreement gives SEIU Local 99 members a larger percentage than the other unions that just reached deals, demanding a level of salary increase that had the potential to be life-changing for the largely low-wage workers that the union represents: bus drivers, custodians, special education assistants, cafeteria workers, gardeners, and other school maintenance and service employees. The deal with SEIU Local 99 resulted in salary increases of more than 30% for many workers, with increases spread out over time and also affected by length of service and current salary. A 24% wage increase over the term of the contract, with increased work hours to ensure that thousands of workers and their families qualify for health care benefits. The rescinding of layoffs of hundreds of technology support workers. The expansion of health care benefits for teacher assistants, after-school workers, community representatives, and others. And limitations on subcontracting for work going to outside vendors when that work could be done by SEIU Local 99 members. The agreement was the third and final milestone needed to avert a walkout and school shutdown in the nation's second largest school district, which comes as a relief to parents of nearly 400,000 students. And of course, all three agreements have been ratified by union members as well as California's Board of Education. Who is already complaining about the question of how the new contracts will be paid for? Keep listening for updates.
That was Kristen Parker with the latest UTLA and LAUSD news. For more information on United Teachers of Los Angeles, you can find it at utla.net.
1, 2, 3, 4, join the marching jobless corps. Work and pay our union dues. What did years of that produce? Houses, cars, and other sh- for the
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
In our latest offering from Steve Zeltzer's Labor Video YouTube channel, we go to a rally outside of the Oakland Federal Courthouse to hear from various people opposed to the proliferation of AI as Elon Musk presses his lawsuit against Sam Altman and OpenAI.
And why are you here today?
Hello, I'm Valerie Sizemore. I'm with Stop AI. The Musk and Altman trial, regardless of who wins the trial, we all lose because they're the two of the biggest AI company CEOs and their product is just completely irresponsible.
And it seems like the government that Trump say deregulate Project 2025, do what you want. Is that a threat to working people and the human beings in this country and the world?
It definitely is. You know, they want to use AI to replace jobs and to surveil us. And both of those things are a huge threat to the working class and really everyone.
And this, it seems like this competition between them, who's going to control the wealth, total monopolization. Is that the nature of capitalism?
Total monopolization is the endpoint of capitalism, I think. And I think it's a pipe dream. It's not a sustainable system. So what they're really doing is driving us all off the edge of a cliff. They think they're going to get the whole pie all to themselves, but there's not going to be any pie left when they're done.
And you have a thing over there with Elon Musk giving the salute, the Nazi salute. I mean, is that their real ideology?
I think so, yeah. I think these guys really are Nazis or fascists, you know, maybe more clearly fascists. If you look at some of the things Mussolini did, there's a lot of, you know, similarity. So I think they did look to those ideologies for inspiration.
And more people are getting fed up in this country. Workers are afraid, even tech workers are afraid of being automated out. It seems like there's no future for the working class if these people are in control. Is that true?
They definitely don't see a future for the working class, I think. Yeah, they would rather not have, the annoying workers that you have to pay and want rights and stuff. Capitalism is actually very anti-democratic. All companies are like little dictatorships, really. And this is one of the problems with it.
So this trial is really about these techno-fascists fighting each other as to who's going to have more wealth.
Exactly. It's just fighting over, you know, a shrinking pie.
And what can people do about it? There is going to be this May Day rally. Workers are talking about a general strike. Do you think that kind of action could challenge this?
A general strike and any kind of getting out in the street action all in a coordinated way is a very good way to challenge the status quo. We do still have a democracy for now, and that is how we get our elected representatives to listen to us and get the change we want to see in the world.
Are you worried about them using this technology to prevent an election, a democratic election, using martial law and spying on people so that people are afraid to go out? I mean, the ICE thugs.
This is already happening. There is already suppression of protesting around the ICE issue, and they are using the surveillance technology they've already put in many towns to follow, harass, and, you know, shut down protesters.
Terrorize people.
Exactly, to terrorize people. They want a reign of terror that they think will give them control.
Ashley Ortiz are saluting Elon. He is, you know, as whenever at the inauguration, whenever he was very grateful to the people, he saluted a couple of times. And we always like to have an inflatable Elon at our Tesla takedown protest at Sunnyvale from 2 to 4 p.m. And he's always there saluting and reminding the people that he is a fascist. He did salute. And you cannot forget it if it's out there for you 2 hours a week, every week.
Are you concerned about people like him, these fascists running the U.S. government?
Absolutely. They are using their money to buy politics. They're using to buy votes. And Elon has already been being sued for doing exactly that, right?
And the purpose is getting more profits.
More profits. He said he wanted to, you know, cut fraud and cut waste within the government. And all he did was very pettily go after things that he didn't like, right? So right now, like Social Security, we're getting our data and people are not safe. Our personal private and data is not safe because of him and Sam Altman and people like Palantir and Alex Karp. So all of them are behind it in our government running it and gaining money off of it.
And they're using AI to deny people in Medicare.
Yes.
And what is, I mean, using them to deny Social Security. I mean, is this a real threat to people?
Absolutely. It's a real threat. It's a real threat to our veterans. It's a real threat to our elderly people, the ones who have worked for many, many years. They put that money into Social Security. I already know I'm not going to see Social Security, but my mom should still be able to use the Social Security that she has and uses for her health care.
Sounds like capitalism is going to make more profit by denying millions of people they're going to die because they can't afford to get health care.
Exactly. And, you know, what better way for them to get money off of us is that if we can't fight it, we're too sick to fight it, or they drag out these lawsuits and they drag out our claims, then if we die, then who's going to make those claims, right? They still get the money off that you get by paying into that insurance every single month.
Well, now they're saying it's going to be great, the wars for AI, that's another profit center, the development of wars and AI. What do you think about that whole mentality?
I think that the mentality of making, of profiting off of war, it's age old, right? I think it's pretty sad, and it's kind of sad seeing it grow into another facet. Like before, we were already making money off of war with, you know, in what we create, right? Just in weapons and exports. But now they're trying to do it in just how we're thinking and guessing games, basically. And basically guessing on if people are going to live or die, or are they going to bomb a school or a hospital? Like, that's dystopian. That's dystopian. I don't want to live in a world where we are hoping that we can get a bunch of money off of something really incredibly terrible happening. Skinomenus is the first battle in the AI wars, isn't it? So they're both watching us. They're both techno-fascists. They're both billionaires. And they're just kind of fighting to see which AI company is going to be at the top, right? OpenAI was founded for the benefit of humanity. That's mostly symbolic now. And even though Elon is trying to say that it's out of principle for ethics, we know that this is really so that XAI can get a, you know, better leg up and kind of get their way to the top again, or anywhere.
Yeah. So it seems like it's all about money, more billions.
Absolutely.
They don't have enough.
They never do, right? Yeah, I mean, the billionaires keep billionaireing. Tesla, Elon alone, you know, with this $1 trillion pay package with shareholders last year, they voted to approve that. If OpenAI does not get kneecapped with this, then they also can become a $1 trillion AI company that is listening to shareholders and not to people.
Mm-hmm. Small people are going out of business. Working people are being automated out mm-hmm. through AI. It seems like the whole society is being organized to give them more trillions of dollars.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's pretty a shame. That's a shame, right? I think that the economy and the people should have more say in AI. They should be able to regulate and decide where and when and if they even want a data center, and if they even want to be opting in or opting out of AI taking over everything and automating their jobs and automating our lives.
And fascism, they're techno-fascist, people have said they don't want any regulation. Is that so they can grab more billions and do what they want as far as the introduction of this AI?
Absolutely, yeah. They say that it's for the benefit of humanity, but again, that's just a smokescreen, so that way they can continue to do what they want unfettered, right? So if they think that, if they've convinced the people that they're doing this for us, then they just get to glean more and more out of us slowly and depleting the society.
Mm-hmm. And there are people calling for a general strike. Do you think that would be one thing that could be done to stop these people?
I do think it's like a small part, right? So it's like we're a stepping stone. So I do think it's one part. If they start getting nervous that the people will actually generally strike and we will stop doing what they want and stop contributing to the machine that's keeping everything going and giving them more and more money, then I do think they would get scared. And I do think that maybe possibly something could happen. But right now, that's going to be people coming together, building communities, creating the mutual aid and stuff that would get them through a general strike as well.
And their idea of the future of the world seems to be without people. Yet, isn't capitalism dependent on people buying products?
I say yes and no. Like, right. And also, like, we could always stray away from capitalism. I think capitalism is one thing, right? But has it really been working for the people as it is, you know? So I'm hoping that we can stray kind of like towards more progressive ideas.
How about humanity instead of problems?
I agree. People over profits forever. And I think the community is over profits. What better way for us to come together than for us to strike together?
Kim Bennett.
Who are you with?
Who am I with?
Far West.
You're an individual.
Oh, yeah, I'm an individual.
But you're in a union.
Yeah, I'm in the SEIU.
Are you afraid of AI? What it is going to eliminate workers?
I mean, it's already eliminated my job. Sort of.
What was your job?
Faculty at CCA. And that is, AI is one of the forces that's making art school not viable.
And you're a teacher there?
Yeah.
So they're using AI to get rid of the teachers.
Well, not directly. I mean, like, the AI pressures on the lower end of the design industry, like, make it harder for our students to consider a career in art and design, making our enrollment drop, making our school go out of business, plus Trump and immigration and all that stuff. And bad management by the people that ran CCA.
Do you think there should be protection of workers? Because it seems like it's unregulated right now. They can do whatever they want. They're taking pictures. They're using, grabbing pictures. They're grabbing work of artists. What do you think about that?
I think the only guardrail that would be helpful in the AI economy is universal basic income. Because no matter what happens, all the money is going to fewer and fewer people. And if that's not distributed, we're just screwed.
The union, SEIU, is a big union in California. They have 750,000 members. What are they doing about this?
Well, I'm not super involved because I don't think I can do anything to save my school. I'm just giving up on that. But, I mean, I appreciate the union's work.
Like, you have a union contract.
Sure. I just, we can't save our school. So I'm not fighting to the death. And it's no fault of the unions.
Capitalism?
Everything is capitalism. I mean, I don't think humans are completely destroyed by capitalism, but it really ruins most of our lives.
It seems that Musk and Altman really don't really care what happens to people in this country.
No, they don't. But that's not, I mean, the system is set up to let those people get away with it.
You think people are waking up in this country?
I don't know. Unclear.
You're out here.
Well, yeah, but I'm an artist. Like, what?
Artists have power. Trump is agitating the artists by attacking them.
I don't think he knows what one is. So, you know, that's another part of the problem. But
what kind of art do you do?
Drawing, embroidery, stuff like that.
So for young people, they won't have a future in art. That's what you're saying?
It's just that the entry-level jobs, as in a lot of professions, are, like, not there. So people will have to bartend longer before they get into, and it disrupts our, this is what the Hollywood strike is about, is our training on ramp is really affected by AI.
And the actors said this was an existential issue for their industry.
Well, it is, because the people who sell culture always just want to skim the top, but we need the entire pipeline to be healthy in order to make good art. And that means we need jobs for 22-year-olds. And you, just because something is easy to automate doesn't mean you can do that, because you need to bring people up.
What should the jury do? It seems like they both are all about getting more money, more trillions of dollars.
I don't know. I don't know what they should do. I don't really know the legal issues, but I don't care. The principals are hand in glove with government now. And so it's not about the people, and it's not about solving critical global problems. We all know it's just about making money.
Isn't that capitalism?
Oh, yeah. It's about capitalism.
Capitalism gone wild?
But it's not even capitalism anymore. We've gone beyond capitalism now, that it's all about feudalism now. It's a return to a cloud-based techno-feudalism, and that's what this is about, because there can be no outcome as they amass more power to consolidate a fascist state. That's my two cents.
That means people's rights go away? Is that techno-feudalism?
Oh, absolutely. They already have.
You don't think they're going to bring in a universal income? And that's what Altman was saying.
No, it's all about marketing now, and these you know, the parties here, it's all about marketing. So, and their share of the loot, their dominance over American financial systems.
You think it's going to collapse? Because it seems like it's a massive bubble, speculative bubble.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure that they would allow it to collapse.
You think they have control of it?
2008, the collapse of the financial system then. Who lost? It wasn't the bankers. It wasn't the people that held all the mortgages. It was the people that owed money. So they'll figure out a way so that even if it does collapse, they'll be able to capitalize on that, on the collapse. They'll make money on the market change, whatever it is. They'll make money on the collapse.
Up or down, they make money. What would be the reaction in this country, you think, if they bring in the draft? What would be the reaction if they brought in the draft now?
Oh, I don't think it would happen. I don't think they can't command enough obedience now to make the draft happen.
But that's very different than Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
People don't
believe that boat is sailed. And but what they won't need a draft. They'll be able to hire enough idiots, basically, to go to war.
Hey, my name's Wind Kaufman.
What does this mean for people? It seems like they're fighting about money. Who's going to control things? That's what this trial is all about.
Yeah, it's, you know, exactly. They are squabbling among themselves because they all are really just after power and control and actually immortality. So these tech billionaires, yeah, they're squabbling among themselves, but really it's a distraction from the real fight, which is between them and us and the other 99%. We cannot allow them to take control of everything, which is really what they want to do. Ultimately, these tech billionaires want control. So we have to wake up to that fact. We have to wake up to the fact that they are megalomaniacs. They're transhumanists, which means that they want to usher a super intelligence into the world that will eradicate humans. And they actually know this, and they're fine with it.
And also, they seems like they think they can, or they are going to profit from war, from AI.
Oh, they absolutely profit from war. I mean, AI profits from so many things: surveillance, genocide, taking over jobs. It's going to destroy humanity before it even kills us.
Well, I mean, the profiteering that they're making. I mean, it seems like these techno-fascists have taken over the government. They're actually running the U.S. government.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about, it's not all about greed. It's partially about greed, and it's partially about power, and it's partially about wanting immortality. So, I mean, I think that we've got to look into all these things and realize that we cannot let these people make the decisions. We have to grab back control. They're not for democracy. And we need to insist that they be controlled. You know, really, AI is a parasite. It has crept into all of our systems, educational, our economic, our political, even our familial systems. And it's destroying them. And we've got to do what we do with parasites, eliminate it. We can't just tolerate it. We can't accommodate it. It's a parasite. We must eliminate it.
Isn't that capitalism?
What, eliminating AI?
I mean, that capitalists want to use AI basically to increase their profits, eliminate human beings, and use this technology really to make billions and trillions of dollars.
Right. And we've got to wake up and realize that that's what's going on and that our democracy is being taken from us and that we've got to stand up and say no.
In San Francisco, we have a billionaire mayor, Daniel Lurie, who...
The head of his transition team was Sam Altman. I mean, he's taking his orders from these tech fascist billionaires, and they're ruining San Francisco.
How is it being ruined?
Well, the inequality between the socioeconomic inequality is getting wider and wider. You've got so many homeless on the streets, people that are hungry, and then you've got like gilded skyscraper.
You know, gentrification.
And you know, definitely gentrification. That's been going on for years, and it's just being exacerbated.
And it's putting ads on. You don't want to attack the billionaires. You don't want to, if you take their money away, that it'll destroy the economy.
Right, which is, you know, we have to counter their propaganda. You know, that's just propaganda. It's not true. And we have to reclaim our voices.
And they, you said, have a fascist kind of ideology.
Absolutely.
And do you think they're in charge of the government?
I think that if they're, well, I think they're already very much in control of a lot of the government. I mean, look at Trump. He's basically beholden to them. So is Mayor Lurie. And I do think that they want ultimate control over the world. I think that's their aim. I do think that none of them are for democracy. It's kind of an open secret. You know, they also support a racist form of eugenics.
They're getting rid of blacks, brown women.
Yeah.
Government agencies getting rid of EEOC.
Yeah. So you can see the symptom.
And what's going to stop it? I mean, it seems like they have total power now. And do you think the working people in this country have the power?
I absolutely do. They only have the power if we give it to them. We really have to stand up, take to the streets if we have to, and say no, and find a community that you can do that with. But we absolutely have to do it, and we can do it. The question is, will you do it?
And I talked to a SEIU member from 1021 here, graphic artist at CCA. She said that they're being destroyed, that AI is destroying their jobs, their future. It seems like a large number of people are going to lose their jobs as a result of it.
Absolutely.
It seems like Stop AI has organized this action here and is organizing around this issue. Is it getting response from people?
You know, it's growing. We went through a little bit of a latent period for internal reasons, but we're back and we're, you know, we're dedicated. And we know that if we don't do this, it's the end of humanity.
That was Steve Zeltzer from his Labor Video YouTube channel. For more videos and insights from Steve Zeltzer, you can go to his Labor Video YouTube channel, or now you can find him at the Production of Labor Video Project on the web at labormedia.net.
And that's our show for this week. Once again, we're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional officers to seriously consider underwriting their show, because Working Voices and KPFK could really use your support. So please contact the station at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org to explore the possibilities. We need to hear from you. You can also email your comments or questions at workingvoices@aol.com. Please contribute if you can at 818-985-5735. This is Joe Ayala. Our thanks to Dan McCrory, Steve Zeltzer, Gary Scott, Kristen Parker, Hal Lohr, and all of our guests. Please continue to give what you can to keep us going. We're in this together. And of course, always remember to educate, agitate, and organize. Have a great week, everybody.
Got so much work, yeah, yeah.
I'm Andrew Tonkovich of KPFK's weekly literary arts show, Bibliocracy. Support this program and the station by hitting the online donations button at kpfk.org. Choose the monthly donation option and, like me, become a sustaining member all year round. Thank you.
Before the 78th remembrance of the Nakba, KPFK 90.7 FM is hosting Sumud,
a celebration of Palestinian culture, resistance, and solidarity. A fundraiser for KPFK, Saturday, May 9th, 4 to 8 p.m. in Mid-Wilshire, with Chris Smalls of the Amazon Labor Union and Nidal Rafidi, Vice President of Teamsters Local 1932. Hosted by Amer Zahr.